everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Real Conversations About Aging Parents. I am your host, Rebecca Tapia. I am going to, before we get started today, going to ask if you could please leave me a review on either Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening to this and share the podcast. My goal is to get to 100 written reviews on at least Apple podcast. So until we get there, I am going to read one bad joke per podcast, and hopefully that will motivate you to go ahead and leave a review so I can stop doing bad jokes. So the bad joke for today is, I'm reading a book on anti-gravity. It's impossible to put down. Yeah, pretty bad. Anyway, so I hope you enjoyed the podcast last week on Medicare. It was a long time coming, and I'm glad we got that out there, and I appreciate the feedback that some of you have sent in. And if you've ever wanted to chat with me or just send me any feedback or ideas for podcasts, you can always email me story, S-T-O-R-Y, at RebeccaTapiaMD.com. I'd be happy to hear from you. So today, I know we've spent some time dissecting things like guilt or the concept of enough, and there's just a lot of heavy hitters in this arena that I want to just dissect one by one and go a little bit deeper. Today, we're going to go into understanding uncertainty, and I bring this up because when I started doing some of this work and talking to patients and talking to friends and exploring my own thoughts and experiences of helping aging parents, I kind of think about it in buckets of different emotions that come at different times. So if we look at the definition of uncertainty, it usually is somewhere in the realm of describing a state of being unsure about the outcome of a situation or the meaning of something. So obviously, in this context, we're talking about being unsure about the outcome, and it can have various degrees of doubt, ambiguity, unpredictability, and typically people experience uncertainty with a sense of anxiety or unease. Now, if you're going on a vacation and it's a surprise and you don't know exactly where you're going to eat that night, you know, maybe there's some uncertainty there, but we don't usually use it in a positive way. So uncertainty is something that permeates all of our lives, right? Start to finish. And how we deal with it changes over time. So even myself having kids at different ages, 9 and 13 right now, how they conceptualize uncertainty, how they approach it, how they deal with it does change as they mature over time. And I think even into adulthood, we're always grappling or coming to terms with how our brain processes uncertainty. So that's what we're going to focus on today, obviously in the context of thinking about life with aging parents. And so when we've had these conversations, and luckily we've had plenty of them by now, you can hear that there's sort of the known knowns, right? So you have a parent and they have this condition and they live in this area. But a lot of the distress focuses around the uncertainty in different areas. So one, let's just talk about health uncertainty. So really, obviously, all of us have some degree of health uncertainty, whether we acknowledge it or not. So health conditions can come on very quickly or slowly or be found out. And so nobody can, even if you go to the best doctor in the world and get all the best tests, can ever give you 100% certainty, even about your own health. But you take population, say 75 and up, if we talk about that population, as we grow older, a lot of chronic illnesses or just an accumulation of illnesses over time, the health uncertainty does tend to grow over time. So in terms of health uncertainty, what you see is there's a degree of uncertainty in a situation, which is for conditions that come and go, like, oh, when's the next flare of this condition, or when's the next surgery, or when's the next crisis is a big one, right? So especially when you're looking at like cardiac conditions or kidney conditions or even neurological conditions, they can have sort of this waxing and waning phases over time. And typically, unless it's an acute phase or like you have a one-time issue, you have a complete recovery, then sometimes you just get stuck with something that just sort of goes through good phases and bad phases, or controlled and then uncontrolled, controlled and then uncontrolled. And especially if the initial experience of that disease or illness was very negative for that person or their family or the people supporting them, obviously there's a lot of angst and anxiety over the uncertainty of, is it going to happen again? Is it going to come back? And I think primarily of cancer-related conditions. So there's usually the diagnosis and then all of the emotion around that, and then the long and drawn out treatment, and then hopefully some degree of control of the disease, and then not knowing if it's going to come back, right? And if it does come back, then knowing, now you've already known how traumatic that experience was. And so that can be part of the problem. So I have a friend of mine who went through a cancer experience last year. Unfortunately, she passed away in December. And one of the last times I'd spoken with her, we had talked a little bit about health uncertainty. And she gave me a word that I had not heard before, which was scanxiety, which is scan anxiety, because a lot of these patients and their families go through scans at certain intervals, say every 3 months or every 6 months or something. And there's a lot of anxiety built up around the reveal of, right, of what the scan is going to say. And I even have one of my own brothers that went through brain cancer at the age of 29, and he would have scans at certain intervals as well. And so I know for my family back in that phase, it was always very triggering, if you will, to go through that anxiety. So health anxiety in general is really challenging. And then you have somebody that potentially you care about, or even if you don't care about them, you might feel cultural or religious pressure to be available to them. And in that context, you can't control their health, right? And you could look at some minor things, like maybe you help them set up a pillbox or make it easier for them to get to the doctor if they have some challenges. But truly, we don't have control over their health. And so when you see that anxiety creep in, one of the ways that people tend to deal with it is to become extremely controlling. And they take the few things they can control and then focus down very, very hard on those couple things. We see this all the time in clinical practice. So because I work in a period of life that is chaotic and very stressful for families, so polytrauma and traumatic brain injury, that's pretty much what it is. Traumatic brain injury, then sometimes I just can tell you all these stories of usually the spouse coming in and focusing in on this one lab value. And I remember one that was a devastating case, and the wife reviewed the labs, she asked for a copy, and one of the iron levels was just a little bit off, and she went ballistic, and she said, oh my gosh, if you had just been giving him iron this whole time, then he would be waking up right now. And he had a catastrophic brain injury. And I remember just really being it was always hard as a clinician to work through that, because a lot of these patients will grieve through the medical team in these situations. So that's one thing. But the second thing, I was just really fascinated by the psychology behind that. So she couldn't control anything that was happening to her husband. She couldn't control the experience for her children as this was happening, but she kind of found this one thing, and then that became a nexus for, if we had just controlled this, then things would have been different. So health anxiety shows up in a lot of different ways. One of the counters to that you can see are those kind of obsessive worrying or controlling type behaviors. And usually that's one of the ways that the brain comes to mitigate what is something that is really largely well outside of our control, even our own health, let alone trying to influence the health of somebody else. So that's the health anxiety and uncertainty. The next one I would say, and I know it's not necessarily relevant for everybody, but it's come up several times in the podcast, is the financial uncertainty, right? And so that's, well, how much is it going to cost to help this person get through this? And we just talked about this in Stephen's podcast just a few weeks ago, talking about his father being in a hospital trying to get to a safe setting, but all of those settings required more money than was available at the time. And so he ended up going home, although that wasn't necessarily the ideal option or the ideal choice at that time. But going through and saying, oh, so we have the health anxiety, we'll put that up on the shelf. The second one, which can loom largely, is just the financial expenditures, right? So if you're going to get a caregiver to come in and you're looking at $25 to $40 an hour for that, where all of a sudden they're on a bunch of prescriptions that aren't covered under their current medication plan. Maybe they were working. We see this a lot. I have a lot of patients that are working well into their 70s, including my dad. He's about to turn 72 this year, still working full time. And once that person experiences a health setback, if that family and that whole ecosystem was dependent on that salary, not only do you have somebody with a health problem, but now you also have intense economic and financial anxiety as well. And so I've had plenty of patients in their 70s that are the breadwinners, continue to be the breadwinners for their family. And so compounding sort of the health anxiety is just now, you know, we have trouble paying our bills. And so I was just talking to a patient this week and I asked him how he was doing. And he said, I'm literally just trying to figure out how to pay my rent because he's 72, still working as a maintenance worker. And so that is a real problem as far as like we don't have really any safety nets for that either. And so the financial anxiety is not just for the person experiencing the health crisis, but if you're taking care of or feel responsible for or otherwise engaged with somebody going through a health crisis, then you're eventually it's like, what about your own financial security? What about the time that you take off of work? Do you get paid time off to do this? Can you take FMLA, which protects your job, but not necessarily your income? Are you going to need to put some money out to buy a hospital bed? Is that person underinsured in some way? And now there's going to be a ton of medical bills or hospital bills. And I see this a lot for patients who have family that are not from the United States, or they're coming to visit and they have some issue and they don't have any coverage. And they're here in the hospital and it's just this intense, you know, how in the world are we going to get through this? There's no money for this. And so I think that's its own separate issue, which is the financial uncertainty. Don't underestimate how important that can be. And healthcare providers are not very good at seeking that out. I'd say social workers and case managers on a team can be, but a lot of the physicians and other parts of the healthcare team are not necessarily in tune with the financial distress that the patient and or family may be going through. And a lot of times there's financial distress in the background, and then we see it manifesting. It's weird. It moves between the buckets as health anxiety. And what you'll hear from a spouse or a family member is he has to get better. And there's a lot of pressure on the healthcare team. And I'm in rehab, right? So we're that last phase of like, okay, he can't be stuck like this forever. Like, you got to make that left arm and that left leg start working because he has to go back to work. And I have had unbelievable conversations with patients, family members, when the patient is clearly struggling to maybe even just get out of bed. And they're like, can you go back to work next week? And there's just bizarre, like, two different worlds that we're talking about here, trying to understand that their financial anxiety starts to manifest as health anxiety. And that's what the language is he just needs to get better. And then it becomes, you know, you need to work harder to get him better. Oh, maybe he needs to be in a more intensive rehab program, even if you are the most intensive rehab program available. Or he needs to be doing therapy 7-8 hours a day, which nobody exercises 8 hours a day on a normal basis. And then so this is just my clinical, like how I come to know the anxiety of any given family and what they're going through. So we talked about health anxiety, and then we talked about financial anxiety. There's another one. I consider these all separate, at least in the way I conceptualize them in my brain. And that's more generically just time and attention, which is different than worrying about health or different than worrying about money. It's that we have a zero-sum game every day, 24 hours. Nobody really gets more or less than that. It's 24 hours. And typically, at that stage in life, so if you're in your 40s, 50s, or 60s, supporting an aging parent in their 70s, 80s, or 90s, usually your time is pretty well spoken for. And when you're looking at somebody in their 50s, maybe even early 60s, they're usually at their max earning potential. They're at the height of their career, if you would say. They're typically building towards their own retirement. Maybe they have grandchildren coming along or children in college. And so when you look at a 24-hour period, typically most of that is spoken for. And so, and just kind of the way that we have our lifestyles here in the West, I mean, there isn't a lot of downtime, I guess you could say social media time, but like in general, We tend to overschedule ourselves. And when a crisis comes up and somebody needs, say you have to fly out of town or you have to go stay with somebody in the hospital, that can introduce a lot of uncertainty as well for time and attention. And so what I've seen, let's talk about when I see this go really well. And I see this even continuously. There's a patient I have right now that has three sons and they just take shifts and it just works seamlessly. Some of them bring a laptop and work from the room. They just stay with her all day long. And I haven't asked them why. I can infer that their father passed away about 2 years ago. And they've sort of mentioned that a way of honoring her and him and what he would have done if he was still here would be to be there with her. And so there's always one of the three sons, every time I go visit this patient, sitting there right next to her, advocating for her, coaching her through things, supporting her. On the other hand, and again, I say that's working well. I don't really know. I haven't asked them, but they seem to have it worked out so that there's a shared burden. But you've heard this throughout the podcast in a lot of situations, either it's an only child or one of the couple of children has really taken on, say, 95% of this. And where this can go wrong, obviously, is their self-care for themselves breaks down. And so now we have the health uncertainty is present, maybe the financial uncertainty because they've left their job behind. And then now you have the time and attention uncertainty, which is, wait, how long are we going to do this? And when we work in the rehab setting, we see this all the time. There's like, what is this going to be, like a week, like 2 weeks, like 3 weeks? No. Like, this is a long-term rehabilitation process for this person. So even once they leave the inpatient rehab setting, they're still going to need probably outpatient therapy 3 times a week, maybe home health, maybe multiple follow-ups. And so really trying to sketch that out and give an idea of what the time and attention that will be needed for this person might help a little bit. But just in general, there's this new introduction of a new unanticipated or sudden demand on what may be already very limited time and attention. And I'll tell you, out of, you know, I can say for every 10 patients I have, there's probably 7 or 8 that don't have anybody in the room almost at any time. It's not actually, I would say, the exception to the rule that the family is able to be there and be supportive and be at the bedside all the time. And so, again, I'm just guesstimating. I don't have any real data on this, but just in my daily experience, the vast majority of these patients are there by themselves. And that can be a lot of different reasons. It just could be sometimes their spouses are elderly. A lot of times they don't have any children of their own or their children live out of town. And when I start talking to them about their children, they usually would say something to the effect of, oh my gosh, you know, my daughter works 60 hours a week. There's no way she could be here. You know, you could text her if you need to talk to her, something like that. So anyway, think about it in terms of what your experience has been. If you've gone through something like this, the health uncertainty, the financial uncertainty, and then the time and attention uncertainty. There's one more I would call maybe a special category, and maybe it does slide in under health. Maybe I should have put it in there. But when you have somebody that has a cognitive decline, I always kind of carve out a special category because this is such a challenging thing, is the rate of decline and being uncertain about how quickly this is happening. And I'm actually doing this right now with my grandmother. And I've talked to you before about my concerns that she's experiencing some mild cognitive impairment, or MCI is what we call it. And it's a little bit tricky at first. You have to kind of be next to it and be seeing it over and over again to be worried about that. And it's not unusual at her age. So she's going to be 91 in November to have some mild impairments. But with the way that those conditions work, you never know if it's just going to be, you know, 1 or 2% every 6 months or every year that you lose, or are we going to fall off a cliff and then suddenly, you know, have some really challenging cognitive decline. And I would say at the rate we're going, I am concerned. And I've shared this with some of my family members because we do live together. I see some of this happening in real time, and not in any way that makes me worried for her safety. And we're still have a lot of the large cognitive systems intact. But I would just say cognitive uncertainty, especially if you've already been given an official diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's or even Parkinson's and some of these other conditions that have a lot of cognitive issues that come with them, or maybe just any progressive condition in general, Parkinson's, ALS, things like that. It's the uncertainty of the rate of change. And so you already don't like the change. None of these are good changes, right? These are not recoveries from an ankle injury. These are like progressive problems in that stage of life. And a lot of it can just be sort of this waiting game. And it can be a very challenging mental place to be when you've been provided a diagnosis that has a fairly predictable future. And being getting the anxiety over the uncertainty of the course of the recovery. So I'm going to go through five or six ways that the brain deals with uncertainty. And of course, this is applicable. We're talking about aging parents, but you can take this and apply it to whatever you want in your life. And as we go through them, I would challenge you to sort of rate yourself. Is this something you use really effectively? Is this something you don't use at all? How effective is this? How healthy is this part of your ability to approach and understand the uncertain parts of your life? So the first thing the brain uses is prediction and inference. And so what it uses, the brain only knows what it's already seen. That's why it's so hard sometimes to dream really big of new things that you can't even conceive of, because your brain has a database that it references. And that's how we deal with a lot of uncertainty. So if I say, oh my gosh, I really don't know how I'm going to bake this cake, and I feel really uncertain the first time, but then I learn, and then I try and I practice. Okay, this is a terrible example because I don't bake cakes. I got to figure out something else. So anyway, think of anything that you could do that once you have a database in your head of how to do something, then you use that database, you draw upon that experience, and then the uncertainty level goes down. That's just part of practicing anything. It happens in my career, right? So you're a very early doctor, you're worried about everything. And then as you mature and as you get more experience, the uncertainty levels decrease in certain areas. You just get better, it gets easier over time. So your brain does have to rely on what it knows, but if it's a new change for your parent or somebody you're taking care of, you don't have a lot to draw on, because what you've drawn on for them is they've always been stronger. They've always been ahead of you. They've always been the opposite. They've been helping you. They've been providing support for you. So you don't have this deep data bank of how to predict the future when this is a phase shift over time. So that first thing the brain is going to do is go into its files and say, well, what do I already know about this? And then try to reduce the uncertainty that way. And if your files are empty, you know, what do you have there? Maybe a way that a friend went through it. Maybe this podcast, hopefully. Maybe that's the best way I can think of this podcast, is I'm going to build files for you. So you have a reference point once these things come up. The next thing that it's going to do is emotional processing. So there's a part of the brain called the amygdala. And I love that word because it means almond, and the actual part of the brain that's called the amygdala looks like an almond, because back in the days when people were dissecting and naming things, they're like, oh, this looks like an almond, so it's called the amygdala. Anyway, it's an extremely important part of the brain, and that is responsible for emotional processing. And it plays a key role in taking an appraisal of the situation and then creating emotion from it. And it highly varies by person. Even if you can think of two different friends in the same experience process those emotions differently, or your children, you might have the same thing happen to all three, but they all three differently process these emotions. So that is a difference in the way that the amygdala has developed its system, its approach to things. And when the amygdala has a very effective emotional processing, so it can take fear and anxiety or excitement and process through them. So rendering those emotions temporary or controlled or acknowledged versus not processing them at all, living in a constant state of fear or anxiety or uncertainty. So that really is almost a mechanical issue. Think of it like a processing unit. So when that unit is doing well, and it typically will perform better, right? If you have good sleep and good nutrition and good friends and walk outside and all those things that we know promote brain health. That's part of how the amygdala works. Now, if you've had a really bad flu and you haven't slept in 3 days and you're really stressed out, the amygdala kind of breaks down a little bit. And I'm sure you've experienced this, right? And so just think about it. There's this little tiny almond-shaped and almond-sized part of the brain that's responsible for emotional processing for your entire life. And so that is a big key. So the uncertainty itself, I can present it to 10 different people and they can have 10 very different experiences. So let's go from the most indifferent is probably what I would say. Hey, there's a lot of uncertainty about your mom and her health and what's going to happen. And they, I don't want to say indifferent to that person, but uncertainty is very comfortable for them. And so they have thoughts like, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. And that's it, right? And so there's a lot of stoic beliefs that when you can rest in, I don't know how fast her cognition is going to decline. Do you know? I don't think you know either. And not knowing to them is a safe space because nobody knows. And so that's on one end, right? And then you could think on the total opposite end is a total nervous Nelly who cannot function because they're so overwhelmed and overcome with the anxiety and fear coming from that uncertainty. And I'm not judging either one of those reactions, but you, when I get this privileged situation I have of being a clinician, trust me, I've seen the entire gamut from one to the other. And it always is interesting kind of where you fall on that line. And a lot of it does have to do with emotional processing, how you conceptualize uncertainty and whether uncertainty feels freeing to you. Like, I don't know. Let's see what happens. Or if uncertainty is very triggering for you. The next one, which is kind of related. So we talked about first, remember prediction and using parts of your files to predict what's going to happen. That's one way the brain deals with uncertainty. Number two was just through emotional processing through the amygdala. Number three is just your cognitive flexibility. So what do you do with new information? And how do you adjust your beliefs and your behaviors because of that? Okay, I'm going to say that again because that's a lot of information, okay? So cognitive flexibility is what do you do with new information? And how do you subsequently adjust your beliefs and behaviors because of it? So that means it's almost like a confidence. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I'm sure I'll figure it out and adapt. And the more cognitively flexible you are, typically the more resilient you are to uncertainty in general or to negative emotions like fear or anxiety in general, because you kind of think you've got your back, like you're going to figure it out. And I know a lot of very cognitively flexible people in my life, and I know a lot of cognitively inflexible people in my life, and so do you. And we all kind of fall on that spectrum from flexible to inflexible, and maybe throughout our life we kind of waver. Maybe some periods we're really inflexible, and again, it goes back to how are you processing new information? And then not only just you get presented with new information, so let's go with a cancer diagnosis, right? Colon cancer. And how do you adjust your beliefs and your behaviors because of that in that context? That has a lot to do with it. Not that you're going to get to a point where that's not a scary thing to hear, or you're not distressed, or you're not sad. The point would not be that. But then how quickly do you move in, you know, alongside that emotion and then start living into your value system or doing things that are consistent with who you conceive yourself to be in that situation with that new information? And of course, you can see the opposite of that, which is inflexibility, which would be new information and completely shut down, like almost like a paralysis and an inflexibility to create new beliefs or behaviors in response to new information. And again, I know sometimes it's a process, so you could start very inflexible for a period of time as you go through shock or grief and then become flexible. But anyway, just as a concept of how people, why there's so much variability and how people handle uncertainty, that is a big part of it. So we've talked about prediction, we've talked about emotional processing, we talked about flexibility, cognitive flexibility. The next thing I want to talk about is more practical, and that's an actionable thing, which is learning. just how do you learn things in general? Because once you get a new diagnosis, and we'll go back to say a new diagnosis of colon cancer, what happens immediately for most people is they have to learn a lot immediately. What does that mean? And what's the prognosis? And what stage is it at? And who's the doctor? And I'm going to research the doctor. I'm going to research the clinic, research this. And then we're going to get genetic information about the cancer. We're going to research that. We're going to do a lot of learning, right? And so sometimes learning can be a coping mechanism. And in fact, there's even a concept in psychology called intellectualization, which is taking a really scary new information and dealing with it by just overstudying it, or almost in a out of proportion to what is actually needed. And so really trying to wrap your head around it. So going back to when my brother was diagnosed with brain cancer, I was, I think, 22, 23 years old, something like that. And I was a medical student at the time. And so I went immediately into intellectualization and I started studying everything about brain cancer that he had and everything he was going through. And I even met with specialists at my medical school, which was separate from where he was at, to learn about his tumor. I remember meeting with a pathologist in the cafeteria. This is a crazy story. I don't know if anybody in my family even knows this, but part of my coping with this was this copious learning is meeting with this pathologist, and I explained the situation. And I remember him looking at me, and he was a very well-respected, I think he was probably 80 at the time, like one of those old school pathologists who just works forever. And I remember him looking at me and saying, "Your brother has less than 5 years to live." And I just sat there and I thought, well, this was totally not what I was expecting to hear at this lunch. And I don't know what I wanted to get out of this, but I felt like I just went backwards. And I had very little cognitive flexibility at the time, so that was really challenging. And right now, thank God, my brother is still with us. He's about almost 20 years out from his diagnosis after a lot of surgery and chemotherapy and radiation. But anyway, so intellectualization is kind of the manifestation of overlearning about something. But just in general, there, no matter what's going on, whether it's a complicated legal issue, a complicated Medicare issue, insurance, it's a complicated something that you're not familiar with, you're going to deal with your uncertainty somehow or some way, usually through some kind of learning process. So that can be how we're going to update our mental model of the world in that context. So what are we putting in our brain sometimes as fast as you possibly can, searching and searching and searching? And the internet has exacerbated this because there's so much information out there. And how do you use learning to help support or control the uncertainty? And then obviously in some ways, learning can exacerbate the uncertainty because now you're introducing a whole lot of factors and a whole lot of other concerns. And of course, I have a million stories as a clinician where this exact thing happens and your patient is going along a certain trajectory and then somebody reads something on the internet and then you have a whole discussion the next day about how that's relevant or not relevant, but they're bringing in new information and creating uncertainty for themselves, typically out of proportion to maybe what even the clinical team is worried about at that time. Another part of the learning is not just the rote memorization of Googling things and figuring out what this diagnosis is, but there's also an incredible amount of social learning that's happening as this goes in the context of aging parents, right? And so something happens and you're looking at, well, what is my brother doing? What is my sister doing? What is my father or my mother doing to help? What are the neighbors thinking? What are the church groups thinking? And what kind of text messages am I getting? And if you go back to the podcast with Anne, she talks about getting text messages from all across her family about how she should or shouldn't be supporting her mother. And so there's a lot of, I say social learning, maybe it's more social pressure as well, but there's a learning process. And I would say at the core of it is, how am I going to show up in this new aspect or iteration of my life? Now this context has changed. This person is sick or they need assistance or something is going on. And how am I learning what to do next? And if you listen to Stephen's story just a few weeks ago, it sounds very intuitive. Like he knew what he was going to do and he did it and there was not a lot of drama. But then I also shared with you other stories on the podcast where it's terrifying. You know, how I don't know what I'm going to do next. And so think of it as a traumatic experience. So there's a new problem or a new diagnosis. But really what's also happening instantaneous with that emotional experience is an incredible amount of learning about themselves, about the other person, about the disease process, about the relationship. And that intensity of learning, just please appreciate how hard that can be on the brain on top of everything else. And so if you're helping somebody all day long, and then you go home and research it for 2 more hours, trying to gain authority over the topic, what your brain is trying to do is gain certainty that you know what's going to happen. And there are no number of Google Scholar, articles out there that are ever going to reassure you. There's just a base amount of uncertainty in these conditions, especially in this age group, that just makes it difficult. So I go back to sort of that cognitive flexibility from resting in the, I don't really know. And I don't mean like not knowing anything, but like, I don't know what's going to happen, all the way into sort of this paralyzing experience of fear and anxiety and uncertainty. So I could talk a lot more about this, but just for today, I think that's probably enough. There's a lot of big concepts that we just talked about. So I hope that you can take this and apply it other places in your life. If there are things that we talked about that you feel like, hey, now would be a good time to brush up on that, to maybe improve my emotional processing or improve my cognitive flexibility, then in the quiet times before things get chaotic and difficult, that might be a good time to think about it. And I do think these things can be modified. I don't think you're born and you're destined to have a certain amount of cognitive flexibility. It's just like anything else in life. It's going to take practice. It may even take some professional mental health support. And I don't think necessarily a mental health professional should only be used in crisis. They're like trainers for the brain, especially for the emotional parts of the brain and the processing parts of the brain, the most important for our day-to-day experience. So I just offer that as this isn't something that you're doomed or destined to be inflexible or to be always destined to just be riddled with uncertainty and fear and anxiety. In fact, I would argue that at that period of time where you have a parent that's at their life expectancy, which is mid-70s or higher, maybe that's not the time you want to be experiencing intense fear and anxiety. What you want to be experiencing is connection and finding ways to find connection or positive quality of life, or have topics other than the illness or other than the decline to be what your brain is occupied with. So I can think of it in a totally different sphere here, which is, if that's what I'm going to want to focus on, especially in that period of life, then how do I orient my brain and my approach the best way that I can manage to do so, so that I am really optimizing connection? And I see, going back to my clinical experiences, I've seen this done very well, which is somebody has a crisis, the family wakes up to the fact that life is finite, there's a sudden jerking into reality, if you will, that none of us are going to be around forever. And then I've seen some really, really beautiful things happen in relationships and sharing and in connection. And that's really one of the special parts of rehab, is you get to see that too. So I'm not just full of bad stories. There are some transformational things that happen once somebody goes through a life-threatening illness. And I think sometimes it puts them way better off than they had been if they had just sort of lived without that realization that life is very precious. Life is finite. It does go away at some point for all of us. And so anyway, I would take everything I just said and put it in that context of, instead of like, oh my God, I'm going to be so worried and I'm going to be so scared. Absolutely. These are scary things that happen. It's maybe thinking creatively or thinking proactively, okay, how am I going to make sure that at least what I can control, which is my way of dealing with this person, this situation, or this person's condition, or whatever, is to the extent possible a healthy, connected way of dealing with this, both for myself and for them and the rest of the community or family that's taking care of them. So, okay, I think I will end there. Thank you so much for listening. Again, please, please, please share the podcast. Please do leave a review. A written review is best for algorithm purposes, and I will be back next week. Thank you so much. Hey everyone, it's Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to take just a moment to review the disclaimer. This podcast is for informational and occasional entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed here is formal medical, legal, or financial advice. By listening to the podcast, we are not creating a patient-doctor relationship between you and myself or any of the guests. Really, it's just me and a possible guest or two, sometimes three, sitting around talking about difficult topics related to aging parents. If you have or suspect that you might have a medical problem or condition, you should seek advice from a licensed medical professional. If you have any questions or concerns, please read the full disclaimer in the show notes or contact me directly. Thank you again for joining us today. I can't wait to see you next week. Have a good day.